Good afternoon. Just wait for this to come up. So I'm going to be talking to you specifically about challenges for states in implementing health care reform for children and youth. We've kind of divided this up a little bit. And I'm going to be focusing particularly on aspects that have to do with coverage, as Mike is going to be focusing a little bit more on preventive and public health aspects. And you can see that these kids in the picture here are really thrilled about health reform. They all look very happy, don't they? Although they look like they're on a roller coaster that's heading down, and all I can hope is that it's going to come back up again. So Karen, do I just... Okay, great. I just wanted to say a word about the National Academy for State Health Policy. I know it's an organization that not all of you may be familiar with. We're not an association, but our primary audience is state policymakers from different branches of government and actually state legislators as well. And we do policy analysis work, and we kind of convene states to try and solve health policy problems. We've been doing work on CHIP since shortly after the program was enacted to support effective implementation of the CHIP programs. And we're also doing work now in addition to the program that Karen mentioned, Maximizing Enrollment for Kids. We're starting in on a new project that I've called Children in the Vanguard, with Atlantic Philanthropy support, to focus on the issues specific to children and health care reform. And we also address a lot of other topics that you all are interested in, EPSDT, juvenile justice. So what I wanted to do was talk really, again, from a state perspective about what the overall challenges are, sort of get the really big picture out there, and then talk about the big picture for kids, what I think we're really trying to achieve for kids, and offer you a few observations. So what I've got up here now are 10 items, five more on the next slide, that are Academy's executive leadership. We had a convening of the executive committee back in summer of this year that they identified as being the things that states had to get right. If health care reform was going to work, there were certain things they felt states had to get right. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these, but I want you to kind of keep those in mind, and I'll circle back to them at the end of my presentation. They are to be strategic with the exchange, meaning, you know, it's not just a place where people can shop for insurance. It offers a number of tools that states can use to really shape the insurance marketplace, regulate insurance effectively. There are a lot of insurance reforms in healthcare reform. There's great variability across the states and how used to regulating the insurance market they are, how adept they are at it. Simplify and integrate eligibility systems. I'm going to talk about that one a little bit. Expand health system capacity. We all know that as more people are covered, we have significant issues in this country about actually having enough care for them to obtain access to. Attending to benefit design. It's not just having the card, it's what it actually gets you. Coordinating care and programs. This has to do partly with coordination of Medicaid and Medicare, which is less relevant to us today. But I think we know that coordinating across programs and making sure that children and youth are connected to a variety of programs that they need is critical. Using your data. We're not going to be effective in health reform unless we really are data-driven. Unless we're really looking at where some of the issues are, what we need to change to make the system better, monitoring people as they enroll and the extent to which they're staying in coverage. Pursuing population health goals, I don't have to explain that one to you all. I probably have to explain it to other state audiences. But that really everything we're doing in reform ought to ultimately be aimed at improving the health of people. And the importance, number 10, of engaging the public, engaging stakeholders in both policy development and implementation. And the last being developing high quality and efficient systems, sort of a big one. So those are all, by the way, on our website. I'm going to have our websites up at the end of this. And I really encourage you to look into those more. We've written a little paper explaining them more. The challenges and opportunities for states in this context of the things that they need to get right is that healthcare reform really gives them an opportunity to pursue goals that many of them have been trying to achieve for some time. Some of them through comprehensive healthcare reform efforts that you know well. Others in more incremental attempts at trying to improve coverage, access, quality, and costs. It's also a great opportunity for the states to be working more effectively together and with the federal administration. This administration is been a real pleasure to work with. They are convening a lot of meetings with states, I think really listening to state input. And it's interesting now, we're hearing states calling not so much for flexibility, that's still important, but many areas now that we've had national standards in place, really looking for more national solutions so that states are not reinventing the wheel 50 times over. Big challenges, though, against all of this that I'm sure you all know well. State budgets in almost all the states are in, still in significant deficit, not deficit because you can't run deficits in state government, but in a situation where states really have to keep working at trying to keep their budgets balanced. State staffing has been reduced significantly, and where folks haven't actually been cut. Many states are having furloughs so that state staff are not available to actually work on things. The complexity of the act, I'm going to be trying to go through this a bit in warp speed, trying to stay within my time. It's incredibly complex. It's challenging to understand. And state policymakers and the state program administrators and staff are very challenged by that. And there actually is very limited federal financial support for administration. It's there for coverage. Most of the coverage costs are provided for in ACA, but not so much on state administration side. I think Congress knew that, but there was only so far they could go in terms of what the bottom line looked like. And last, but I'm sure on many of your minds, is the changing political leadership picture. I think others on the panel may talk more perhaps about what's happening in Congress. I just want to point out there's, as you all know, a big shift going on in the states. This map shows the light-colored states are the ones where there's been a gain by that party. So the kind of pink states are where the Republican, there's now a Republican governor where before there was a Democratic governor and vice versa. Light blue is where there was a Republican governor previously and now a Democratic governor. This is only governors. It doesn't show you what's happening with state legislators. And if you did like I read the New York Times front page article this morning, you know that 20 states now, there's a Republican control of both of the entire government, basically, governor's offices in both branches of the legislature. They picked up more than half of those states in these elections, and I think there was only about four states that turned totally Democratic. And of course, those bring specific, those states will vary, those governors will vary, but they bring some particular agendas that are important as we think about reform. So let me now kind of focus in on kids and tell you maybe this is, I think this is probably a collective vision, one that AmChip worked on over the years, Karen and I, when we were there, Mike and his group continuing to do so. And I think as you all think about this, to me there's kind of three big buckets that we're looking to have universal and continuous coverage of children and youth. In a family-centered system, you know, we've all been talking a lot about how we can't deal with children outside the context of family. I think ACA offers a lot to help us really pursue that vision. Coverage and financing of the services that children and youth need, and last but importantly, access to coordinated systems, not just between healthcare and public health, which is important, but also between health components and other services that children and families need. This is working, right? Yeah. So I'm going to first talk about coverage and probably spend most of my time on that one and touch on the other areas more lightly. I want to review first, again, what I think anybody probably that was interested in coming to this session or is being at APHA knows. There's a strong connection between parents' coverage and children's coverage. There isn't, and again, this is something that with other groups of state policymakers I may need to explain. But there is some evidence that if parents become covered, it's more likely that their children will have health insurance. States that covered parents under CHIP, many of them found this. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that children of mothers that have significant problems like depression or substance abuse are themselves at greater risk of those problems. And there's also some correlation between mothers seeking out health care that correlates with the likelihood that their children will get preventive care. So it is important, not only because it's important to adults that they have coverage, but it's important to their kids. So what did we get in terms of family pathways to coverage in ACA? Hopefully you know many of these, but I'm going to touch on them. Very important insurance market reforms. Plans now have to be issued. You can't really be denied coverage, including on the basis of pre-existing conditions. This is mostly all going to be effective in 2014. There are, as you know, mandates to carry coverage, and there's mandates for and penalties affecting employers in terms of offering that coverage. And we're going to have state and national, or national, and I should actually say, or regional. I think some states are thinking about banning together exchanges in place by 2014, which means states are working on them now. And those will offer subsidies for people under 400% of poverty. We're also going to have national minimum Medicaid eligibility standards, which I've put in caps there, major. This offers a major, major opportunity to simplify the system. If we have a national standard of eligibility, and not every state is deciding how much income to count or not count, what to disregard, using the terminology, it does make for a much simpler system. We are also going to have, again, a high federal match that will wind down a bit, but we're still going to have 90% federal match by 2020. This does present some real challenges as states are trying to think about how to simplify radically. We still have some older categories of eligibility for Medicaid that are important, that are another pathway in, particularly for people with disabilities, kids in foster care, people that have high medical expenses that can basically spend down to Medicaid eligibility. They all still need to be able to gain Medicaid eligibility. So it complicates that notion of a simple system, as does the need to track new eligibles versus old, because states are going to get a higher match for the new eligibles. Kids' pathways. Kids really have a lot of pathways now. The ban on pre-existing condition exclusions went into effect pretty much immediately for kids. And kids are eligible either for Medicaid, those other categories that I talked about, either income-based or other categories. CHIP, which picks up after Medicaid and goes up past 300% of poverty in some states, as well as exchange subsidies. Okay. I won't spend a lot of time on CHIP. I do want to say, though, since I spend a lot of my time on this, it is reauthorized through 2019, but the funding is only through 2015. So there really are big question marks about the future of CHIP, and this is something we may want to talk about in the Q&A. We're also going to have some shifting, some kids going from CHIP to Medicaid and Medicaid to CHIP that we're all going to have to pay attention to. And the coordinated eligibility and enrollment systems, there really are a lot of provisions in the law that talk about really having no wrong door, being able to apply multiple places, only having to apply once, though, and having everything that you submit, say, for Medicaid also be considered for whether you qualify for the exchanges or for CHIP. I won't go through the rest of these in the interest of time. We've got more money for outreach, requirements for Medicaid to do outreach to children, including children with special health care needs specifically. So let me touch briefly on coverage of services, reminding us why this is so important in terms of being specific to kids, and that's because kids do have different needs. Medicaid right now, its EPSDT program embodies a pediatric medical necessity standard. Most private insurance plans don't do that, and CHIP kind of falls in between. We're going to have to really watch what happens with the exchange plans, I think, on this aspect. And also, as we all know, children's physical, social, emotional, educational needs are all intertwined. So again, Mike is going to talk a lot about these benefits, especially preventive, so I'm not going to say a lot, but just to know for kids with special needs that are in need of hospice care, there was a change to allow them to continue to receive treatment services, which was not paid for previously while they're in hospice. We have new required benefits for private plans, and again, I think Mike's going to touch on a lot of these. But this also, I would say, is radical. I mean, the notion of having a national standard benefit package, a minimum benefit package, is a new thing. There's lots of question marks about how it's going to be interpreted. We all need to be part of that conversation. A lot of this will be set by HHS, but states basically are going to be able to add additional benefits. They'll have to pay for them, and maybe that's not going to be terribly feasible right now. Well, 2014, possibly a little bit more feasible, maybe beyond. This provision I have to stop and talk about briefly. The secretary is required to certify which plans in the exchange are comparable to CHIP in terms of benefits and cost sharing. There originally was language to say, and if they're not comparable, then kids can't get moved to those plans. That language is no longer there, so it's only got half a tooth, if you will, this provision. But I think it's a handle, again, to hold on to in terms of ensuring the quality of plans for kids in the exchanges. And I will wrap up shortly in just saying that there are, well, we know, again, that kids' needs for service systems are different from adults. There's a lot of different places where kids are seen. There are multiple different funding streams, including Title V, that feed into their services. A lot of that's not explicitly addressed in the Act, but there are a lot of different provisions that talk about really building more coordinated systems that I think Title V, maternal and child health, services for kids and youth can be built into. Again, Mike is going to talk about many of the ones on prevention, some of the ones on safety net. I'll just notice, you know, this advanced practice nurse-managed health clinics authorized for underserved populations, that sounds like a neat option for me. That's one of many, many provisions in the law that's not funded. And I don't think there's going to be immediate prospects for funding many of these unfunded grants, but again, in the future, we may have some chance. Quality measurement, a lot was done in CHIPRA, the CHIP reauthorization bill, so that much of what's in ACA has to do with adults. But there is now a national quality strategy, and that needs to address everybody, including women and children. Coordination and systems development, I do want to stop a second on the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI. The jewel was apparently a statement that Don Berwick made, who's the new CMS administrator, that CMMI is the jewel in the ACA. $10 million available to test new models of care. A lot of opportunity there to really shape systems that will meet the kind of needs that we all focus on. A lot of grants not funded again. So let me wrap up by just saying what I think are some of the take-homes is that it is important to take a strategic and systemic approach. The law gives us a lot of tools. Some tools are stronger than others. Some tools are more complicated than others. But the tools are there, and it really is, I think, up to everybody to wield them to really make the kind of systems that we want. That we can, I think one of the messages I would try and get out in your states is that it's important to achieve early success with kids. We already have a head start. We've got a lot of kids covered. We've been working on simplifications in eligibility systems for kids. Let's build on that, get more of the kids covered, and basically have a building block and a lot of mostly healthy folks covered by the time we hit 2014. Those 10 components I talk about, we have to make sure kids' needs are attended to in each of those 10. The notion, I think Mike, I saw his slides in advance, had this same concept there. This notion of no wrong door, which is really in the law around eligibility, we should really think about trying to expand that whole concept to access and to the content of services. There's a kid, or really anybody, but starting with kids, ought to be able to get the same kinds of benefits, coverage and quality, no matter which door they're walking through, what coverage that they have. And just the importance of all working together on this. So thank you very much. Look forward to the Q&A.